This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For years, parents, teachers, coaches, and others have subscribed to the philosophy that if a child participates in an activity, they need to be recognized or rewarded. It isn't just the player who makes the most baskets or touchdowns who gets the trophy at the end of the season. All of the participants need to get a trophy just for participating. The theory is that these rewards raise a child's self-esteem. Trouble is, that philosophy may be wrong. Ashley Merriman is the best-selling author of Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children, and Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, which comes out very quickly, very shortly. She says that meaningless, undeserved praise produces kids who don't try hard enough, give up easier, take less risks, and simply collapse when they fail. Before we talk to her, however, let's hear from a super achiever who simply disagrees with Ashley Merriman, Stephen Colbert.
Next up, folks, I am hyper-competitive, and if you don't know that by now, well, then I give up. So I am giving a wag of the finger to the New York Times science writer Ashley Merriman for an op-ed she wrote last week entitled, "Losing is Good for You." Well, if you really feel that way, Ms. Merriman, great news. I think you're a loser. Merriman here claims America has gone trophy crazy, especially when it comes to our kids, and that after years of researching the effects of praise on kids, quote, "the science is clear. Awards can be powerful motivators, but nonstop recognition does not inspire children to succeed. Instead, it can cause them to underachieve." Wrong! Wrong. This country was built on awards. What do you think gave Washington the confidence to defeat the British? It was his fourth grade most improved karate participation trophy.
So she's made it. Ashley Merriman, thanks for joining us. When you're on the Stephen Colbert Show, or when you're referenced by Stephen, I guess that means you've had an impact on society at large.
It was a very weird evening. My Facebook account started going crazy. People were like, "and your picture, and so Colbert, and I'm like, what are you talking about?"
That's obviously, it surprised you, huh? What did it do?
Yes, absolutely.
What did it do for you, having him mention you?
Well, a lot of people told me to check it off my bucket list, and I was like, it didn't occur to me that was on my bucket list, but okay.
He, of course, held up his two Emmy Awards immediately after that.
He did, and I actually tweeted him that he missed the point of the piece, because the Colbert Show won and the Daily Show lost. So I told him that the essay wasn't for him, it was actually for Stewart.
I see. Well, okay. Well, and Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, which comes out shortly, actually deals with a lot of the winning and losing aspects, the competition aspects of all of this. Your book, Nurture Shock, however, New Thinking About Children, is said to be one of the most influential books about children ever published. I thought that was Dr. Spock's book, but I guess I was wrong. It's turned the conventional wisdom, at least the recent conventional wisdom, about child rearing on its ear. How did you come to the conclusion that giving a trophy simply for participating was a bad thing?
Well, I have to start by saying I'm one of those people who would praise kids for, you know, coming in the door and not falling down. I was effusive in my praise. And I've actually been running an inner city all-volunteer little free tutoring program in inner city Los Angeles for now it's about 15 years. When I first found this research, it was about 5 years ago. And I was horrified to hear that actually praise, telling kids, "oh my gosh, you're so smart, oh my gosh, you're so talented," might actually lead them to underachieve. Mm. Because that's exactly what I had been telling my tutoring kids all along.
Right.
And what the research and where I really started changing my understanding was Stanford's Carol Dweck. She asked the sort of question, well, 85% of American parents think it's important to praise kids for intelligence. Are they right? What does that do? And she started with a single experiment with fifth graders, 400 of them. And she brought them in and said, gave them a task to do. And then when they finished, she told half of them, "oh, you did really well. You must be really smart." And she told the other half, "oh, you did really well. You must have worked hard." And what she found is all of the kids loved the praise. Didn't matter if it was worked hard or were smart. But then she gave them tasks that were designed for seventh graders, 2 years too difficult for them. And they started panicking. The kids who had been praised for being smart, assigned at random, they weren't actually, there were no IQ tests, right? The kids who were told they were smart and doing the seventh grade task were sweating and pulling their hair, and they wanted to go home. But the kids who'd been praised for effort were saying, wow, this is my favorite one so far. They were bombing, but they enjoyed the experience. And then she gave them another couple tasks and then had them repeat the same task at the beginning. Now, they should all improve, right? It's a practice effect. You do it a few times, you get it. The kids who had been praised for intelligence, on average, did 30% worse than they had at the beginning, whereas the kids who'd been praised for effort did about 20% better. And what we've learned is that praise, it's not that it's ineffectual. It's that kids get so invested in these titles that they don't want to do anything to disprove it. And they can't come back from failure, because if success is taught, well, it's based on this innate skill. You've either got it or you don't. You're smart or you're not. Then effort is for losers. So kids who are constantly told you're smart, are afraid, and they'd rather cheat than genuinely try something and be told, oh, so you're not so smart after all. Sorry.
Boy, this is really multi-layered, isn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of things going on in that. Let's go back just a little bit to this phenomenon of getting an award just for being on the planet and breathing. Is this an American phenomenon, or has this been going on all over the world, or do you know?
Well, the research is a little bit tough, but the trophy industry research, there is a trophy industry.
Yes, there is.
And
you call it the trophy industrial complex.
I do. And at first I thought it was a joke. And then I started getting hate mail from the trophy lobbyists. And I said, wow, there really is an industrial complex. No, I'm not. I've gotten letters saying, listen, young lady, trophies work. And it's a $3 billion industry in the U.S. and Canada. And but truly no one knows. The best estimate I've seen from researchers in terms of how many trophies, certificates, and everything is millions and millions.
So are you saying that the trophy industrial complex, the trophy places that I know about, because when I was a kid, nobody got trophies. It was very rare you got a trophy, were these little shabby places. They were very dusty, and you walk into maybe and you buy a trophy for your annual banquet for somebody, and that was it. And what you're saying here is that now they're just they're pushing these trophies out like they're automobiles.
I typed in the word trophy into Amazon once and got over 3,000 results.
Wow. So are they actually influencing people actively? Like, are they influencing Little League and Pee Wee Leagues? And
I actually have, especially in the past year or so, because, there have been so many budget crunches, I've been collecting stories of city councils that ask their community, now, which would you like for our local Little League team? A full season of games, or everyone gets a trophy? Because that's the choice. Mm-hmm. And parents are actually saying, we'd rather play less games and have kids get trophies. AYSO soccer divisions, not all of them do this, but there are many of them spend more money on trophies, which everyone gets just for registering. They don't even need to come. Just for registering, it's on the form. You get, with your $40, a team picture and a trophy. And a lot of these organizations actually spend more money on trophies than they do on coach training, kid training, equipment. And they also spend a lot of money on trophy on those photos. So to me, the message is sort of, you don't actually need to be good at it. You don't need to be good at soccer. You just need to look good at soccer, because you get a uniform and a picture and a trophy.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you date this phenomenon of praising everybody and giving them trophies back to 1969 to a book by Nathaniel Brandon called The Psychology of Self-Esteem. It said that self-esteem was the single most important facet of a person.
Right.
Wow. So since then, we've done everything we can to assure that a child's self-esteem is built up. And now your book comes along and says just the opposite.
Right.
We're doing it completely wrong, and that it's a self-defeating proposition. We know what the impact of his book has been. Mm-hmm. What might be the impact of yours?
Well, I think a lot of people have been hearing the praise research. I talked about Dweck's experiment, and they're saying, wow, maybe I need to stop telling my kids they're so smart. And thinking more specifically about how you praise kids, how we talk to them. And I've heard from hundreds, if not thousands, of parents who tell me personally that they've changed the way they're talking to their kids. And actually, since the New York Times piece came out about everybody shouldn't get trophies, I'm getting emails from around the country saying we are rethinking our trophy program.
And Poe Bronson, your co-author, has written about how he's changed how he treats and talks to his children.
Yes. So I think there's institutionally, there are people who are changing programs. Poe actually runs a soccer program in San Francisco, and he was giving out about 3,000 to 4,000 trophies every couple months. And he's restructuring the way they do it so that kids will get less trophies and understand that it's an actual accomplishment. And I was really struck, just to show you the opposite one more time. I mentioned my tutoring program. A few weeks ago, a girl came in, and she was very proud, and she said, "Look, Ashley, I graduated." Well, this was in October of fifth grade, so I knew that wasn't true. And she said, "No, I got a certificate. I graduated." And I read it, and she had gotten a certificate of achievement for having done 8 hours of homework, in English specifically. And I made her rewrite her essay, and she was very annoyed with me. She showed me the certificate and said, "I have a piece of paper that says I'm done with English homework. Why do I have to rewrite my essay?"
Wow. You know, his book comes along. What's his name? Nathaniel Brandon comes along, and everybody suddenly gets trophies. Your book comes along, and it says, "Don't do that," and people are now beginning to change and not do that. Who's right?
Oh, me.
I mean, we live in an age.
Silly question.
Well, we live in an age where these things come out. These scientists study things or authors write things. And suddenly everybody gets on that bandwagon and goes down that road for a while until they suddenly say, "No, that's wrong." And they reverse and change and make a right turn and go the other way. Are we just messing with things? Why don't we just leave people alone?
Well,
let them do what they want.
It's a good question. Well, you know, Brandon said self-esteem is the most important thing. But to be fair to him, his definition of it was different than what you and I think in terms of the we need to tell people they're great. You have to be wonderful. And that actually really kicked off in 1984 with the state of California had a task force on self-esteem. And the idea is, especially in underserved, struggling financial communities, if we boost kids' self-esteem, then they'll have more achievement because they'll sort of be fearless. And that became the idea. And then researchers started studying for about 30 years, proving that self-esteem meant kids used drugs less, drank less, better grades, nicer roommates. But a few years ago, the Association for Psychological Science asked Roy Baumeister, a researcher at the University of Florida, to do a review of the literature so that he would prove that self-esteem does all these great things. And he realized of the almost 15,000 studies that he had looked for, not only 200 of them were actually what he would consider to be a good scientific methodology, because most of them were based on self-report. Are you a nice person? I'm fabulous. Are you attractive? Oh, my God, I'm the most attractive person I know. And what we realize is, not surprisingly, people with high self-esteem think they're awesome. But when you look for what the roommate says about their roommate, when you look about their college transcript or what their SAT scores, he found that there was no evidence that people with high self-esteem inherently have higher achievement, higher grades. In fact, the opposite.
And I only have 30 seconds here, but I read yesterday that sometimes people who are abusive or bossy or bullies are they ascribe that to people that they're having low self-esteem.
Right.
But in fact, they think very highly of themselves.
Absolutely. How dare you talk back to me? I'm wonderful. And if you knew that, you'd tell me I was.
Ashley Merriman is our guest. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, presenting a guest lecture February 1st at 6 p.m. by internationally acclaimed architect Mario Botta, designer of the Beckler Building. Details at beckler.org. Tomorrow we're going to meet some people using plants in different ways for different purposes. First, we hear from teachers working to green up the schools. They say that school gardens reduce nature deficit disorder. We're going to find that that's really a disorder, too. Also, they say it helps with obesity, childhood obesity, and it helps children learn better. So we'll hear from the Green Teacher Network in the first part of our program, and then meet a man who uses plants to make amazing works of art described as voluptuously magnificent. He joins us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a surge in anti-abortion measures in more than half the states has altered the landscape for abortion availability. Access to abortion on the 41st anniversary of Roe v. Wade.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ashley Merriman is our guest. She has written, along with Poe Brunson, a book called Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. Her latest book with Poe is called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. I misspoke. It is out. It's been out. It was published in February of last year, but the paperback is about to come out. That's what I was confused about. She is speaking about this tonight at the McGlowan Theater here at Spirit Square at 7:30, and again tomorrow morning at 9:30 at the Levine Jewish Community Center. Information about both of those talks is on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Let me share with you a couple of comments that have come in as we've been talking. Tish on Facebook: giving all children a reward is a terrible idea. It just tells children that hard work doesn't matter and makes them lazy later on in the real world as adults. And I do want to talk about that adult aspect of this as we go through. You would agree with that? Because you're nodding.
I absolutely would agree.
Nodding vigorously.
So good on radio, so yes.
Dustin emails: I'm wondering what your guest thinks about the president winning the Nobel Peace Prize. Is this an example of your current conversation, or did he actually do something to deserve it? Great question.
Yeah, that is a great question. You know, I think a lot of times the Nobel is a symbol of people who are rallying to a cause, and it's not actually necessarily what someone has or hasn't done. I mean, he was early on in his presidency. So there were definitely foreign policy achievements that he had made, but I think the award was because of the symbol of possibility. And that would be, you know, Malala this summer was having the same sort of phenomenon.
Let me ask you a personal question.
Okay.
See, I believe in awards where the award is based on math, where it's based on quantifying something. There's no question if you have the highest number of yards in the NFL, and if there's an award for that, well, then that's quantifiable. Mm-hmm. You can say that's absolutely verifiable. There's no question about that. But awards like the Oscars and the Tonys and things like that, to me, are absolutely ludicrous and meaningless, because it's just somebody's opinion or the collective of opinions of people who are politically involved, which makes it
their Oscar campaign.
It just means nothing. It means nothing. It means, although we make a big deal out of it, it's fun to handicap the Oscars. It just means nothing. Am I wrong?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and since I'm sure both of us at some point are going to be nominated for Oscars and Peabody's, we love them and respect the institution. Or at least I do. You can go for it.
I've actually said this publicly. I've never been awarded anything, and that's probably why. But go ahead.
But actually, it's interesting. We write about that in Top Dog, why sports are so important in our culture. And I'm one of those people who, you know, often says, well, shouldn't scientists be as famous or more famous than a sports celebrity? Why do we care? And a researcher at Oberlin and researchers at Bryn Mawr, Robert Washington, have thought that, well, why is that? Why do we care who wins? And it's because there's clear results. And that so much going on in our life is actually vague. I mean, you have to trust someone who gives you a statement of how Wall Street's going, or a company, or the Pentagon. But if you go to a sports game, if you read in the newspaper, you hear on NPR, this is the score, that was the score.
But that's quantifiable.
Exactly.
And
but
if
that's,
you're a scientist
that's
who
the
finds
appeal.
If you're a scientist who finds the cure for HIV, then yeah, give that guy or that woman an award,
right?
Because that's quantifiable.
Absolutely,
it's not my opinion that you did it.
Well, but that's why those are so exciting to you and to other people, is because they do seem understandable. I don't need training. I can see these are the scores, and that's why it's something like a sports steroid scandal so upsetting. Because the idea is, well, I thought this was quantifiable. I thought, you know, the number of hits was the number of hits, but now you're telling me maybe it wasn't. And that's why those are so upsetting. And that's why, you know, people will often argue, you know, figure skating is not a real sport. It's not that figure skaters aren't athletes, but they're wondering, because, you know, the judges are sort of, you know, well, I thought that was prettier.
Yes,
that they object.
And if you skate first, you will not get a high score because they have to, by rules,
set a baseline.
They have to set a baseline. So you're handicapped by going first.
It's
not fair.
No, it isn't. Yeah. The unluck of the draw. Yeah, I do think, though, there is value in those other awards, things like the Oscars, the Tonys, because they do inspire and challenge us to think in new ways. And, you know, as an author myself, you know, I'm often hearing, well, you know, serious artists aren't worried about things like awards and competition. Mm-hmm. Michelangelo had an agent.
He did?
He did. And he actually had a contract for the Pietà. And in the terms of the agreement, it was promised that the Pietà would be the greatest sculpture Rome had ever seen. And at the time, there was already this thing called the Colosseum and the Forum. Da Vinci had been walking around. And it was a contractual term that if his sculpture wasn't the greatest anyone in Rome and Renaissance hadn't seen, he wouldn't get paid.
Wow.
And he got paid. Wow. So setting those standards, and actually in the Renaissance, they would do that all the time. Raphael would specifically do a contract and say, my altar for this church will be better than so-and-so's altar for that church. And it gives us standards that I think pushes us higher. So even if on a given – I mean, I actually worked on the Academy Awards 1 year. And it's true, I did when I was in college. And, you know, the sort of cliche is that you never win an Oscar for the thing you deserved it for. You win an Oscar for the thing that you didn't.
Right.
So, you know, I think the famous example is Julie Andrews won for Mary Poppins because she had lost the year before for Sound of Music. And so I think that, yes, there is political elements to it that make sort of head scratch. But on the other hand, there is a value in having them because it pushes us to expect more and demand more. And maybe there's some independent filmmaker who watches the Oscars in a couple weeks and says, that one? Well, I can do better than that. And if he gets out of camera and he does better, I think we all win.
Okay, you're making me rethink this whole thing. let me bring Derek into this conversation. Derek in Fort Mill. Welcome to the program, Derek.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good morning, Derek.
Yeah, I've had this discussion with dozens of parents over the years. I'm a regional director for a child development organization for the past 10-plus years, and our mission is to instill life skills and help build self-esteem through sports. So we carry around bags of balls and things. We consider ourselves educators as opposed to sports people. We've given out thousands of trophies over the year, but we kind of have done, a balance which might dovetail nicely with sort of what you're talking about.
Derek, you're breaking up, so try to stay in one place for a moment and make your point.
Okay, I was watching. How is this?
That's okay. Go ahead.
All right. So how we do it, it's an international organization, so we actually started out in South Africa. There's a little bit different baseline there. But we have a small – we focus on mostly preschool kids and early elementary. We have small classes, 8 to 10 kids, and each week one or two of them will get a trophy. It has nothing to do with how well they do athletically. It's how they, if they try their best, or a good listener, or good sports, which are the rules of our class. They get to keep it for that week. And the next week, trying to teach a little responsibility, they bring it back to class, and they get to be part of a ceremony that gives it to another child within the class. And that seems to have worked well, because that trophy, I've gotten pictures from Hawaii, from Grandma's house, and they're little dollar trophies. I tell them we could give a tennis ball, and it wouldn't matter. It's a bit of recognition. But the part that we try to explain to parents, the conversation I've had quite often, is that the trophy isn't really for the child who necessarily gets it. It's for the children who don't. Because if I have 8 3-year-olds in there, and all of them desperately want this little piece of plastic, and I give it to one of the children in the class, if the other 7 congratulate and are actually happy for that child, I think it's a really important lesson that we've taught them as well. And I've actually been threatened over the years that their children need to get the trophy, and not a big surprise, their children were bullies, and that was one of the reasons that they might not be getting it. So I tried to work with them. I actually had police come out one time undercover because I was threatened, and they decided to come out to the following class, and
so
that parent never showed up.
So what's your take on that methodology?
Wow, so many takes. Well, for one thing, I have to say, to me, the money line was I was threatened because I wasn't giving trophies outright.
Right.
And to me, that means then you should stop giving trophies because there should parents should not be thinking that this is so important for my 3 or 4 year old to get that bodily injury is at stake. That really upsets me. But I also think, you know, I'm not anti-trophies, but I want kids to actually do something to achieve it. And my concern in this particular instance, I mean, I like the idea that you have to get it and that it's not yours permanently and that you give it away. And I like the idea that you should congratulate kids. And I think that's really important because, you know, we only say it doesn't matter if you win or lose. It's how you played the game. We only say that to the loser. Right?
Yes.
But you have to learn how to congratulate someone for doing something. And that's hard. And I like that idea. But preschoolers are not coming to an activity like this to get a trophy. They're coming to learn social skills. They're coming to learn how to play, to run. And the idea that we give them trophies to do that tells them, even at 3 and 4, just learning, just having fun isn't good enough. And I'd rather have kids have a few years when they're just learning stuff without feeling I'm being judged.
And as a play on what you just said about it's not how you
win or lose, it's how you play the game.
Mm-hmm. You never hear Oscar winners say it's just a thrill to be nominated.
Exactly.
Only the losers say that. Derek, thank you for your call. Getting back to children and what he said, you point out in your book that children are not stupid. They know when the reward that they're getting, the certificate, the trophy, is not earned.
Absolutely.
They see other children who are, in fact, better at whatever it is than they are. And when they get the trophy and they know that other person is better, they see it as what? Phony? Fake? A lie? What do they see?
Oh, absolutely. Really, kids, you know, up until about the age of 2 or 3, if you ask them who's the best reader, I'm the best reader, even if at 2 they can't read at all, I'm the best reader. But by 3 and 4, earlier if they're siblings, they actually are very accurate in knowing who's the best athlete, who's the nicest, who's the best reader, who's the best drawer. And it's confusing and upsetting to them when we're told that they have, when they're told they have to pretend everyone's the same. I've heard actually stories from older kids that were given participation medals they didn't think they earned, and they were so furious they threw them in a trash can and set them on fire during the award ceremony. I'm not advocating vandalism. I'm not advocating vandalism, but that's how important it is for them.
Yeah.
And kids want this opportunity to feel that they can, you know, prove themselves. And everybody tells me that all of the kids have 2 piles of trophies at home, the real ones and the fake ones.
Wow.
And that they know which ones are which. And even not just trophies, but praise. The research says that kids have heard so much empty praise, things like, oh, you're so special, that they don't even believe it at 7. And by 12 years old, they actually think that hearing praise means I'm a sign I'm worried about you. Because
so they know the psychology.
They know we're trying to manipulate them into doing something or encouraging them. And in some ways, that was a little bit of what I think Derek was saying in terms of the kid who's actually struggling is the one who gets it. It was good for the kids who had to learn how to congratulate him. But the kid who's struggling, he knows he's struggling. So to tell him, oh, you're great, I think in some ways messes up our validity. Because when we're having trouble, are they going to come to ask us for an opinion? Because they know we'll tell them a lie.
And you're not really saying in any of this that you should never praise a child. On the
Absolutely
contrary,
not.
What you're saying is you don't praise them for things they cannot control. Because you either have a high IQ or you don't. There's nothing you can do.
Right.
You praise them for things that they can control, like making an effort.
Right, absolutely. And truly, even for kids with a high IQ, at a certain point, it's not about the IQ, it's what they do with it. And every time you learn something, your IQ improves, right? And especially for kids.
And
what we want to do is teach, you know, give praise when it's sincere, honest praise. That's my praise uber tip. It has to be honest. I mean, I know parents who've been praising their kids for sliding down a slide, not because they were afraid, but they just did it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, dude, gravity works, and your kid's not the first one who came up with that. They're just doing it for fun. They don't need praise.
Right.
But if they're genuinely doing something that's hard for them, you know, if they're afraid of the slide because it's falling and you want to praise them, say, okay, that was, you were brave and you did that and I'm proud of you. But what we want to do is focus on praising what they do, not who they are. Because you can always change what you do. You can't change who you are. Mm-hmm. So it's not just, oh, you're a great artist, but I like how you use different colored crayons. Because the next time they draw, they can remember, oh, hey, she liked it when I used different crayons.
So let's flip the coin.
Sure.
If praise, indiscriminate praise, is a negative, and the kids see through it, and it even demoralizes them in some senses.
Often.
What about criticism? How do you use criticism? Is that equally bad, or is there some merit in being critical?
It's a great question, and I think the main thing is it's about warmth and supportiveness. You don't have to beat kids. You don't have to abuse kids. I don't want to hurt kids. Mm-hmm. But with my tone, I can say, wow, well, I don't really think that essay was up to your standards. Can we work on this? This paragraph needs work. I don't think I said anything in my tone or indication that should make the kid cry. And most of the time, they know it. In fact, Carol Dweck says sometimes the best praise isn't praise at all. It's saying, well, how do you think you did? Because now the kid themselves is thinking, I did work hard on this, or I didn't, and I should probably check to make sure I, you know, catch all my misspellings and my errors. And giving them the idea of what I need to work on. And researchers have explained to me that, you know, the A student is not the kid who gets 100% every grade. The A student walks out of a quiz, and you say, hey, honey, how'd you do? I think I did all right. I missed question number 3 and 5, 6 and 7. Oh, I don't know, maybe half credit, but the rest of them I did fine. Your kid who's struggling, the D student, the F student, walks out of the same quiz. Hey, honey, how'd you do? Oh, I don't know. They could get an A or an F. Either way, it's a surprise.
Hmm.
And that's the problem, is they're not in tune to actually be looking and judging their own work. They need everyone else to tell them that was great, that was wonderful, that was terrible. But if you don't have that own sense, you can't ask for extra help because you don't know if you've got it or not. So the best praise is that kind of, here are specific things you should be looking for. How do you think you did? And then giving kids the way, the tools to do it the next time better.
More stuff that's coming. People, you're getting a lot of emails. Chris emails, the trophies are worthless and cheaply made. My kids are 15 and 16. They don't care about the trophies they have for participating in sports because they know they are meaningless. Don't even get me started on snacks. 1 hour of peewee soccer or flag football and kids get crappy juice boxes and a bag of Doritos. I didn't know that. That does not motivate me to want to play. Jennifer on Facebook, what do parents, educators, leagues fear the most about stopping the constant rewards? My guess is it's not the change in kids' behaviors, but other parents, educators, and leagues. What do you think about that?
I've had coaches say it's pressure amongst the team. If I don't give out trophies, the kids will go to someone else's league.
And is that pressure coming from the parents who expect
it? Yes, the parents. And well-meaning, but the parents are saying, no, my kid needs trophies because my kid needs to build their self-esteem.
When we come back, I want to talk about what happens to these trophy kids when they become adults and enter the workplace. We're seeing evidence of this already. I'm going to get your take on all this. Ashley Merriman's our guest. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and exceptional artists. Presenting an intimate evening with a ukulele artist, and I can't say his name, so I'll let Ashley Merriman say his name, Jake
Shimabaruku. And I'm a huge fan. He's spectacular, so everyone should come.
Well, he's here February 3rd at the McGlone Theater in Spirit Square. Information at carolinatix.org. You have to stay here for tomorrow now because I can't do this tomorrow either. A surge in anti-abortion measures in more than half the states has altered the landscape for abortion availability. Diane Rehm and her guest will be talking about how access to abortion has changed in the 41 years since the landmark Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision. That's in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. Perhaps you have a question or a comment for our guest, Ashley Merriman, about her pronunciation of that ukulele player or what we're talking about this morning. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks will get you to us.
Business news. It's not all banks and budgets and bottom lines, you know. At Marketplace, we think it could be lots of things.
The big trends are leather and lace.
I think that the studio knows that movie was a mistake.
I love twerk like no one really should.
Oreos and milk.
I'm Kai Rizdon, whether you need news or the numbers or just a little chuckle. We'll have it for you next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ashley Merriam and our guest, the author of, along with Poe Bronson, of Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. Also Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, which I hope to have a chance to get into as we go through the program. She's speaking tonight at the McGlowan Theater at 7:30 here at Spirit Square and tomorrow morning at 9:30 at the Levine Jewish Community Center. Let's talk about these kids, these trophy kids who have grown up, because this all started, as we mentioned, in 1969 with this book.
Right.
And it took a while to build, but I've noticed a change, and everybody who goes to any athletic event for children knows that everybody gets a trophy now just for being there. So what happens when they grow up in the workplace? They've always been praised, even when they fail, and they don't really know how to deal with failure. What happens to those people?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The researchers, especially of kids, have said that very question. And I've also heard, teachers say, I can't deal with the parent emails when I give their students Bs. And the parents complain, raise their grades.
Yeah, this is happening in college.
Well, the teachers rationalize that we change the grades. And they tell me, but, you know, in college, college is college. So they'll get real grades there. They'll wake up.
Yeah.
And then I've had psychology professors who know the science saying, I've got to give A's because the dean expects X number of students in my class and I've got to get butts in the seat. But it's okay because they'll graduate and they'll go to work, and work is the actual real world, and they'll learn it then. And I have stories of employers who've handed out Starbucks gift cards because people show up to work on time. What it is, it's this message, well, everything you do just by showing up is good enough. And we're not giving people time to understand it takes a long time to get good at something, that you don't get rewarded just for doing the minimum, that you actually have to work hard.
And when they find that out, what is their reaction?
Well, it's interesting. There aren't any actual studies, but anecdotally I've heard from a lot of companies that say that they often quit.
Well, prior to the recession, mm-hmm. we did a number of programs on this show about how businesses needed, and these were experts coming in telling us,
right.
how businesses needed to adapt to the new workplace expectations of the millennials. We were told that they work differently. They want to be in on decision making on day one of
right.
a brand new job. They want to set their own hours. Mm-hmm. They needed playtime at work. They wanted to be able to be free to come and go at will as long as they got the work done, set their own schedule. They wanted to be promoted quickly or they would leave.
Mm-hmm.
And the business would have to learn to adapt. Now, I sat here and listened to this over 4 and 5 sessions, and I thought, this is ludicrous. This is ridiculous. How can you expect a business to operate to just be on the whims of their employees? You can't.
And the juniorest employees.
Yes.
I mean, that's the most
yes.
outrageous part.
Now, we have not heard this in the wake of the recession because you can't get a job.
I have, actually, though.
Have you?
I mean, I thought that the recession would sort of cure it
yeah.
because, people who were underperforming would be firing. And I've heard from companies saying that the assistant to third vice president is upset because the vice president's pictures are on the website, but theirs aren't.
Yes.
And they've actually caused such a fuss that the company started redesigning the website so that even the secretary's pictures were on the website along with the corporate officers. And I was like, are you kidding me? I'm like, give me that company's phone number. I'm sure I know people who will work without so much recognition.
I mean, but when we were having these discussions and people were saying, well, if you don't do these things, they'll leave because
right.
they know that there's a better job around the corner. Now, prior to the recession, there could have been some truth to that. But my reaction, because I'm just an old dinosaur waiting to die, my reaction is, so what? There's the door.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Now, was I completely off base? And were others who felt the same way completely off base? Or is there something to be said for the shifting needs, desires, and expectations of new generations? Because new generations do bring new ideas into the workplace.
I think the answer is yes. No, I think the answer is that, you know, with technology, things like the occasional ability to work from home or change the work hours might actually lead to some productivity, depending on the person. But on the other hand, there are a lot of studies that say, well, actually, you need to be in the office because having a face-to-face interaction is not the same as sending someone a text or an email.
Right.
So I think it's not an either-or. I think that there are some aspects that if we can encourage people to be more creative in the office, you know, use technology, use an environment so they're more productive, that's fine. But if it's just a way to entertain a certain percentage of the office, that's not going to work.
But
also, the research says that, you know, the highly motivated person, whether they're a baby boomer or a millennial,
we'll get it
wants
done.
To succeed.
Right.
And they want to be recognized for that.
Did this – I mean, some have described this as entitled and narcissistic,
mm-hmm.
and childlike in terms of expectation, play at work, for instance.
Right.
And that stems from these technology companies who do hire young people who are marvelously talented and who do get some of their best thinking when they're playing because they're designing video games.
They're designing games, exactly.
But is that a result of their having grown up in this culture of praise and trophy awarding and award awarding, or is it from something else?
Well, the tech companies, you know, Google famously was, you know, giving people a day of free thinking where they didn't actually have to work, right? That was sort of became a famous idea. Well, they just canceled it. It wasn't for everyone. It was just for their top-level engineers. Everyone thought even receptionists got a day when they didn't have to answer the phones, and that wasn't true. But the top guys at Google are working 80, 90 hours a week. So if you give them 8 hours of time, or if you give them a pool table in the office, they're still working
right.
70 hours a week.
Right. Exactly.
So the story that came from the tech communities and people tried to transfer in other contexts, I don't think worked because it was a different work environment. And now you are talking about, well, we just entertain people because we couldn't expect them to actually be working that many hours. And again, the high performers, you know, do want to succeed. And people who are focused and obsessed and in terms of that, you know, is there a longitudinal effect of this? Carol Dweck had Columbia undergrads, and she, you know, they think very highly of their intelligence. They're at an Ivy League school. They've worked hard their whole lives. And she had them do an EEG study. So she was mapping brain activity while they were doing a trivia quiz. And she had asked them, well, you know, do you take classes for the rank? Do you take classes for the grade? Or do you take classes for how much you're going to learn? And the students who took classes for how much they learned, and the trivia quiz was rigged, so they would only get 40% right. Yeah. So you can imagine this is humiliating, right? You're at Columbia, you think you're smart, and the computer just keeps telling you wrong, wrong, wrong. And if you got a question right, the questions got harder and harder and harder, so there's no way you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who picked classes for the knowledge and what they would learn learned the answer. Even when it said wrong, their brain was sort of active throughout the question, and they learned that new obscure trivia question. But the people who were focused on, I only take this for the grade, and I only take this to know I'm going to be number one in my class, the only part of their brain that was active really through after they'd been told they were wrong was the amygdala, which is the part of the brain we talk about as being a fear center of the brain. It was as if they were afraid of the right information because it proved they were wrong. And when she did a retest, they didn't learn any of that information.
Wow.
And other work where they've done that, they've done tutoring programs for, you know, college students in, you know, post-calculus and statistics. And the students who are focused on their rank and their recognition, when they struggle, their brains panic and they literally can't take that information in. So that's, to me, one of the main concerns. If you have someone, you know, and you're not even, you know, entertaining them, you're not, you know, I think the buzzword people use is, are we coddling young people? If you're not coddling them, but you have a warm environment, are they actually going to panic that they physically can't learn? And honestly, if they physically are, you know, if their brains are shutting down and overwhelmed, yeah, I would quit that job. Who wants that job?
Yeah. We all hear that America to be successful in the 21st century must learn how to be or become more competitive than it already is today. We live in this already competitive society, it seems to me, but we're not competitive enough, I suppose, with the rest of the world. And if you look at test scores and things like that, we're well behind other countries. So are we equipped to compete in this environment, having given out trophies just for breathing all these years because these kids can't cope with losing? So are we equipped to compete if we're not ready to lose occasionally?
I think that's exactly the question. Is no, I can't promise you that you're going to win every time. But the benefit of competition isn't winning. The benefit is improvement. You know, if our students are learning more, then they will be over time improving in the ranking.
But tell that to all those football coaches who were fired for not making the playoffs.
Well, football coaches have a specific job, and that's to win.
To win, yeah.
But I have to say, at a certain point, if they had said, we lost on the playoffs, but our record is 20% better than last year, they might have kept that job, right? Because the improvement was there. And that's what we want to have for kids, is having them see, I didn't necessarily win this time, I wasn't perfect, but I've improved. If I've improved now, I can prove tomorrow.
Yeah.
Again, what you were saying earlier, it needs to be under someone's control whether or not they're successful. The sad news is, or maybe this is good news for us, it's not just an American phenomenon. I had an Israeli journalist was interviewing me, and she said that she's been collecting stories of mothers who were calling Israeli generals complaining that their sons didn't have enough time to eat lunch during boot camp.
Unbelievable.
So, but that doesn't mean we should keep doing this kind of thing. We have to let kids struggle because it's not about making them feel like losers. It's about them knowing I can come back from the mistake. I can come back from the defeat.
Why are the parents doing this? I mean, the parents probably were not raised that way. They were raised in a stricter, more conventional environment. Why then are they doing this to their children?
Well, the National Bureau of Economic Research asked that question. And researchers there decided it was what they called the kindergarten rugrat race. Parents, especially college-educated mothers, spend 8 hours more in child care rearing now than they did in 1975. It's a full work day, more of driving kids around, working on their homework. And it wasn't a steady progression of time. Only about an hour of increase in time in childcare from 1975 to 1998. It skyrocketed after that. And what they think is around late 1990s, there was a baby boom. And that's when we started hearing about there's not enough places for kids in preschool or daycare.
Right.
And parents started saying, well, if my kid can't get in the right preschool and there's no room for him in school, then he's not going to get the good college. He's not going to get the good job. And it became this sort of parade of horribles. So parents started saying, well, then I've got to do everything possible I can so that my kid's an Uber kid, so he gets all of those things. So I think that's really the concern, was the kids were struggling and the parents were thinking there literally was no room in the inn, so they had to prepare the kids for that. The good news, however, is that the scarcity in schools is done. It's over. We don't expect the same high population of college-entering freshmen until at least 2020. In fact, last year's matriculating college class was actually the lowest it had been since, I think, at least 10 years.
So parents can relax.
Because their kid will get in, yes.
We're going to run out of time, but I want to hopscotch quickly now through a couple of things. This book is not just about praise and behavior.
That's true.
It's about other things. Like, for instance, you write about how kids today around the world get an hour less sleep than they did 30 years ago. What's the significance, quickly, of that?
Well, 15 minutes more sleep. A students get 15 minutes more sleep than B students, who get 15 minutes more than C. It turns out that we think of sleep as this sort of black box loss of time, but it's in sleep that your brain takes what it's learned during the day and then actually sort of moves it into long-term memory. So you know the answer to 2 + 2, but you don't have to picture the day you learned that. Who taught you?
You're defragging your hard drive.
Exactly. You're defragging and you're moving the stuff from the RAM to the long term.
You also get into why children lie.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they lie?
They are literally telling you what you want to hear. Did you break the vase? No. They're trying to make you happy and proud of them, and they don't want you to be disappointed in them. So they actually think that the lie, I mean, a 3 or 4 year old might actually have some sort of magical thinking, and if they denied breaking the vase, then maybe they didn't actually, and somehow time travel changed. But what they really want to do is make you proud of them. You know, it's the same thing with praise. Kids love hearing their daddy's little angel, and they'll do anything they can to keep it.
And you say that when children lie and the parents discover the lie, they often threaten to punish the child, and that's the wrong thing to do.
Well, and they also focus on breaking the vase and not the lie, which gets confusing to kids.
So what should you do?
What you should
actually do it? Actually punish them? Not threaten, just do it.
Well, no, what you need to do is start differently. Instead of saying, did you break the vase? You know they break the vase. You already know that, right?
How did you break the vase?
Or it would make me really happy if you told me the truth. How did you break the vase? Because now the happiness isn't coming from the lie, what I told you. What we want to hear is the honesty. And that problem is we focus too much on we're going to punish the lie and not encouraging honesty.
You have a whole section about teenagers lying, which I'd love to get into, but we don't have the time for that. So you'll have to buy the book to find that out. But I do want to give you a chance to say something that will make a lot of parents happy about teenagers, because you say that a teenager's arguing with their parents is actually a sign of respect.
That's absolutely true. It's so much easier to lie and go out the window and go to the after party. To argue with me means I care enough about your opinion. I'm actually telling you what's going on in my life. And if I lose the argument, I'm going to change my behavior. So to have teens arguing with parents means they're going to continue to talk to you.
You know, to read more about that, you'll have to get the book. Ashley Merriman, a journalist, best-selling author with Poe Bronson of Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children, and Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte.